I can almost feel my stomach dropping down below me. I'm one of those folks who just love roller coasters. I don't lift my hands up all the time, but I do enjoy the front car. You know, I think Forrest Gump had it all wrong. Life isn't like a box of chocolates. It's more like a roller coaster filled with ups and downs. This is Focus on the Family, and for some encouragement about the ups and downs of life and the God who is in control through it all, I hope you'll stay with us as we spend some time with a good friend. Our host is psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, and I'm Mike Trout. Doctor?
Well, Mike, today we're going to do something just a little bit different from what we usually do here on Focus on the Family.
Oh, good. Not the same old thing again.
That boring stuff. We have a guest here who is not a professional counselor or a therapist. She didn't make any pretensions about being an expert on the family. But I tell you, she's lived a lot of life and has had a lot of experiences that are relevant to the family and to women especially. And she has a lot of wisdom, just natural, good old-fashioned wisdom like my mother had.
Oh, that's
and
great.
It's always fun talking to her. She is a lovely, warm, charming person, talented lady, used to work on the staff of Focus on the Family, has resigned to go on to other responsibilities, but she has written a book, and she's come back to see us today. And it is a delight to have her with
us. Sure is. She shares often on the weekend broadcast, and she'll write about an experience she's had that relates to Scripture. And if any verse comes to mind to describe her, as I think about Scripture, it's Colossians 4, verse 6. Let your conversation be always full of grace and seasoned with salt.
You're a salty person.
Thank you. I've been called worse.
I meant that kindly.
And I accept it. Thank you so much.
We're talking about and talking to Sandra Aldrich, who has really been here a number of times on the broadcast, and many of our listeners know her. She speaks around the country. In fact, that's what you're doing now, isn't it?
Yes.
Speaking and writing. That's your profession now.
Can you imagine all the relatives who told me to sit down and shut up, and now they're horrified that I get actually paid to talk around the country. I'm having a ball.
And that program you were talking about, a 90-second commentary on our weekend broadcast, is called Single Moment.
That's right. And we use it maybe two or three times a month on the weekend program.
Sandra, you have a new book. I think it just came out, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
This is published by Tyndale, and it's called Men Read Newspapers, Not Minds. Did you just insult all the men in the world by that title?
Well, no, I thought I heard a collective sigh, because I'm always hearing these little wives say, well, he should just know. And I'm always saying, honey, men don't read minds. They read newspapers, believe me.
Let's talk about your childhood. You grew up in Kentucky.
Oh, yes.
You're a hillbilly.
No,
right?
Sir.
No, not a hillbilly.
No, sir.
I'm sorry.
Now,
you know that
I love you more than life itself, but don't you start calling me bad names. No.
What are you? Tell me.
I am from the hills of Kentucky.
And that's
yes.
Not a hillbilly.
Oh, no, sir.
I see.
And I'm from Harlan County, and that's where I learned to fight dirty, so you don't want to call me bad names. But I react to that because my family was part of the Great Migration that in the early 50s came up out of the closed coal mines, the ruined farms. And I grew up in the Detroit area in a little place called Chelsea. And it's a wonderful, wonderful little town, but they weren't terribly pleased about having us there. And so that term was never applied with any type of fun or joking, and I still find myself reacting to that.
They were not pleased to have you there because you were from the hill country?
Yes, and of course our fathers, as they moved up into that area, they worked in the factories, and the people were saying that these people are taking our jobs, and we talked funny. I remember one time I was telling a story, and I was telling a Southerner's response, and someone said to my husband, says, oh, says, I love it, the way she can imitate the Southerner. And Don laughed and says, believe me, she imitates the Northerner. And so here we
You've lost some of it, haven't you?
Sir, I have not lost it. I've just hidden it rather well. But I taught for 15 years in the Detroit area, taught public speaking, and you can't have Northern kids leave your classroom with a Southern accent, so I still... Some of the words, like even Harlan County, you don't say Harlan County. It's not Harlan County. It's Harlan County.
You know, I was born in Louisiana, grew up in Texas and Oklahoma. When I first went to college in California, people laughed whenever I spoke. I'd say one sentence and people would make some comment about my accent. I've lost it now, and I don't know where that happened because it was not a conscious effort on my part. But it is interesting how the culture has an influence on you little by little.
It does. And won't everyone be surprised when we all get to heaven and God talks with a southern accent?
You know, I was born in Richmond, Virginia, and moved from there just before I was five. And when I go back to visit relatives, even having left as early as I did, it's still very easy to fall back into a lot of the speech patterns. And to feel comfortable in that environment.
I don't hear that in your voice either, Mike.
No, that's the Southern California coming through.
Sandra, I referred earlier to your natural wisdom. I like the way you see life and the way you express it. Do you attribute some of that to your growing up where you did and in the family you did?
One of my favorite poems is Alfred Lloyd Tennyson's Odysseus. And you remember the line where Odysseus says, "I am part of all that I have met." Oh. And so everything that's happened in my life has made me the person that I am. And I found safety and love in Kentucky and with my Kentucky relatives. And I belonged there. So, of course, I'm going to lean toward that and embrace the way of life that we had there.
Was your father a farmer?
He was for a while. We lost the farm. We had bad crops 2 years in a row, and then disease hit the cattle, and so we had to sell. See? We had to sell. And
We had to sell.
Leave.
Is that what you're saying?
I can't talk.
We had to sell.
Louisiana, West Virginia,
S-A-I-L, sell, right?
Or just sail north, I guess.
We had to bail out of there. No, when we basically lost the farm. And my dad had not worked in the coal mines because his father had been killed in the coal mines. My dad was 2 when his dad died. And so he chose then after World War II, he chose to go into farming, and that was a disaster. And so we were part of all the folks that moved north.
Well, you speak very warmly about your family and the influences back there. Mama Farley must have been an interesting lady, your grandmother.
Yes, she was the matriarch, and she truly, even though she couldn't read, she understood the Titus 2:4 concept, that the older women in the church, in the community, are to be teaching the younger women how to love their husbands, how to love their children, and that's what she did, and the whole community respected her and looked to her for her wisdom. And occasionally when I'll do something especially feisty, one of the cousins will say, "You put me in the mind of Mama." And I always say, "Thank you." It's a wonderful compliment.
She sit and talk to you for many hours things she believed?
But it wasn't, "Come over here, honey, I'm going to teach you about life." While we were snapping beans or canning or while she was braiding a rug or combing my hair, she was just always talking. She was always talking about the Lord. And, of course, I would go to her with some problem in my young life. Oh, to have those problems now. And I would be complaining. And she would listen, and then she would just say, "Well, now, honey, there are some things in life that all you can do with them is bear them. And you bear them by hanging on to the Lord." And I didn't want to bear them. I wanted her to fix them. I wanted her to take care of that person. But I remember her voice even these years later. And when things happen that I don't like, and I say, "All right, Lord, that one's yours, but I know that I have my part, too, and that's to bear it."
Now, you bore a pretty heavy responsibility within the family as a kid. You had to work hard, didn't you?
Oh, I did, but I think any eldest child does because the parents have such high expectations for that first child. Bless our hearts. And I was the oldest of 5 living children, and we just, like any big family, there were a lot of responsibilities. And I learned a lot. There were a lot of things I wish I could do over again. I wish I had had more fun. I'm still trying to discover what that word is, and I think sometimes that's why I create my own outrageous fun.
You really didn't have much time for childhood.
Didn't, and there was just a lot of things going on, and again, when you feel ostracized by the community, and that's the way I felt, and that's why I was always longing to get back to Kentucky. And who knows, you know, in the next few years, I may finally get back there, but I just figure my next move, it's been Kentucky, Michigan, New York, Colorado, and I figure my next move is either heaven or Kentucky. So it's about the same difference, isn't it?
Do you ever see the movie Trip to Bountiful?
Oh.
That's my favorite movie of all times, I think.
I watch it once a year.
Yeah.
I love it.
Geraldine Page starred in that. And the whole theme of the movie is she has this passion like you to get back to the memory of where she was raised and that romanticized idea. And she finally gets there and it's gone. You can't go home again.
Yeah. Oh, no. And I have been back and I have stood at empty lots where store buildings used to be, where the house used to be. And I have stood there and I've cried. But yeah. It's locked in my heart.
Yes.
And so I still have it there. The little church is still there, and I'm delighted by that, and good memories there. So lots of fun things. And just as you carry those memories of Texas, Louisiana?
I do. When I go back, the thing that hits me is how much it's shrunk. You know, I saw it as a child. Now I see it as 6'2", and it looks very, very different. So, all right, let's take you on into the college years. You went to Eastern Michigan, I believe?
Yes, I always say that
I know more about you than you want me to know.
I always say that I have my master's degree from Eastern Michigan and my PhD from the School of Hard Knocks. Mm-hmm. But I met my husband at Eastern. We were in InterVarsity together, and I remember in this meeting I heard someone laugh. And, of course, I'd had this very somber life, and I turned toward the sound. I couldn't believe that someone could laugh like that, and I was just immediately drawn to his laughter. And from there, and then I found out his background was Scottish, and I thought, a Scotsman with a wonderful laugh? It was all over for him. He didn't have a prayer after that.
And you dated for how long?
We dated for about a year and a half, but I knew that I was going to marry him even before we started dating. It's just I had to wait until he caught up with the idea.
But there were some troubles with his family. His folks weren't excited about you.
Oh, dear. Bless their hearts. No, they used the word that Dr. Dobson used at the beginning of the program.
HB, right?
They weren't exactly thrilled that he was marrying a girl from the hills. But I have to say that my parents weren't exactly thrilled that I was marrying a northerner either. And our first argument of all things, once we were married, was over gravy. Because southerners have milk gravy, northerners have what we would call brown sop, the beef gravy. And our parents understood, it wasn't that they were against us personally, they just understood the cultural hurdles that we would have. But I remember one time my folks were being a little bit standoffish to him, and I asked Don that night, I said, how could you be so nice when they were trying to ignore you? And he says, Sam, he says, I love your parents now because they're your parents. And he said, one of these days, I'm going to love them for who they are just as they're going to love me. And that is exactly
the
way
it eventually occurred.
Oh, yes. In fact, when Don died, they were just brokenhearted because they had lost a son. And he is now buried in my family plot. That's where he wanted to be. And that's where they wanted him to be. That, they said, that's for family, Don's family. Yes,
did you ever come to terms with your in-laws?
Oh, my, yes. Oh, I did. And, in fact, your listeners can take this one and run with it. Probably the smartest thing I did early in the marriage was I decided that I was going to just be nice. And so you never have to apologize for things that you don't say. And so I would let Don hear about it in the car, unfortunately, but I was nice to them. And I kept inviting them for dinner. And then on Don's 30th birthday, I sent his mother 30 sweetheart roses with a little note that said, thank you. I'm so glad you had a baby boy 30 years ago today.
Oh, that's neat.
And I really meant it. I wasn't being manipulative. I truly meant that. But any walls that were left were just melted right down. Because I loved my husband, and I was determined to follow his lead and love his parents.
Now, you have already told us, Sandra, that you lost Don. In fact, you had been married 16 years.
Yes.
When he died. He had cancer, didn't he?
Yes, brain cancer, and he died right after Christmas in 1982. Jay had just turned 10, and Holly was 8 and a half. And that was scary. As I've told you before, you know, here I was, a Kentucky gal who was raised to take care of a man and young'uns and have a big garden, and I hadn't planned on single parenting being part of it. That just wasn't part of my agenda. But in the midst of all of that, the Lord's reality and how that I just hang on to him. I still claim Isaiah 54:5, for thy maker is thy husband. The Lord Almighty is his name. And so I would just turn to him and say, I don't have a clue how to do this. I didn't know how to pump gas. I didn't know how to reconcile the checkbook. Why should I reconcile myself to the checkbook? I wasn't mad at it. So I just had to concentrate on him in order to get through these past 14 years.
Had he been healthy up to the time of the diagnosis?
Oh, yes. He played. He had tennis trophies. He played sports. He was just involved in all sorts of physical activities. He'd been very healthy. And so it was quite a shock when this cancer showed up. It started out as malignant melanoma on his shoulder, just a simple mole that changed. He ignored it. Bless your hearts, you men are so much in denial. When that happens, get to the doctor. And by the time that I discovered it, I just had to go into mild hysterics to get him into the doctor. And it metastasized. It went through the bloodstream, hit his brain, and then he died 16 months later.
Sandra, how'd you go about letting him go and giving him to the Lord? Was that a wrenching experience in those months when he was dying?
That was awful. But if cancer has any silver lining, it's what we call anticipatory grief. And so I had time to get used to the idea, because I was one of those women. Again, there were men's roles, there were women's roles, and we were very much into that, not in any abusive type situation. It's just that we were comfortable with that. Suddenly I was in charge of everything. And when the doctors would come in to talk to him, he would say, you have to wait until my wife comes. She makes the decisions. And I didn't like that, but it was getting me ready for what I was going to have to do. And I think what we have to do when we're grieving is find that one area that we can be thankful for. I was thankful that the Lord was preparing me for that.
So all of a sudden you have the full responsibility for two kids who are on the verge of adolescence. You have the responsibility to earn a living. I assume you didn't have a big nest egg by that point. You have to run the house, you have to repair the car, you have to fix the roof, you have to pay the medical bills, you have to do absolutely everything, and grieve as a new widow. How did you cope with that? Because we're talking to people who are there.
I cried a lot, but I'm not into public hysteria, because you can't communicate if your nose is running. And so I kept those times for the Lord, and I did let the kids see me grieve, but not in the out-of-control times, because children are frightened enough. So many times, as you know, when children lose one parent, they lose the other parent emotionally.
And or fear that they will.
Yes. And I was just determined that that I would still be there for them. And it was a lot of hard work. But again, back to Mama Farley. Honey, there are some things in life that all you can do with them is bear them. And so I didn't have any choice except to try to choose wisely each day and to get through the day hanging on to the Lord. That's the only way we do it. And I learned far more than I ever wanted to know about cars. I can now change my own oil. Mm-hmm. And
I can't see you doing that, Sandra.
She can change it, but does she change it?
I can change it, and I wore, it was very feminine, though. I wore pink plastic gloves, so it was all right. But I must confess, with the 10-minute oil places now, I don't bother. But I know that I can if I had to. And this was somebody who didn't even know how to pump gas, so that point of changing oil became a personal challenge to me. And a lot of things I didn't know how to do. And I think this is where the church is so vital in any loss, whether it's through death or divorce, to be there, to help the person learn how to do these things. You know, at the funeral, people were always saying, well, just call me if you have any needs at all. I had so many. How could I choose one? But I did make one call. I had had a blowout on the expressway there. And I knew I had to get new tires, and I called one of our friends, and I said, I don't know how to get tires. Now, all he would have had to have said was, Sandra, take your Sears card, go down, they'll help you, get road handlers. That's all he'd have to say is something like that. Instead, he said, now listen, you're going to have to learn to start doing things like this on your own. You're going to have to learn to make these decisions. And I just closed up, and I thought,
oh, goodness.
There's no way I'm going to ask anybody else for help. And so with all of these needs, I really felt as though I was carrying it alone, humanly. Of course, the Lord was there.
It was that characteristic of everybody in the church? Did anybody reach out to you?
There were two out of, we had had all these folks over at the house all the time. There are two folks who still stood by me, actually three couples, and I'm just so grateful for them. That I had those three. But because of that situation, the tires, I didn't want to be burdening them. So I was always learning by trial and error.
Sandra, how long did it take your kids to adjust to the new life without their father and the changing relationship with you? As you implied a few minutes ago, whenever you have a single parent situation, usually one child will take the place of the absent spouse. And kind of play that role. And I don't mean in any kind of romantic or sexual way, but will step into that vacuum, that authority position. Did one of your kids do that?
No. First of all, both children still miss their dad, and Jay especially has missed having a godly man in his life. But I remember just before Jay's grandfather went back to Florida, he told him, he said, "Now you take care of your mother. You're the man of the house now." And I was standing where I could see the panic that washed over this 10-year-old.
That's a terrible thing to say to a 10-year-old.
Isn't that awful? Yeah. And so what I said very quickly is I said, "No, Dad, he's the 10-year-old son in this house." And Jay still remembers that, and he remembers the relief that he felt. And so he didn't feel as though that he had to take that role. Now, of course, he's 24, and he's very protective of Mom. Mm. But he didn't feel as though that he had to replace his dad. And I'm so grateful that God allowed me to be there when the grandfather said that, and so that I could encourage him in the proper role.
Well, as a testament to your character and strength, Sandra, you not only survived as a single mother, you put them both through college.
Yes.
With a little help from them, I'm sure. They've both graduated now.
Oh, and I'm so thrilled.
And you're doing fine. You're speaking and you're writing, and you have this new book. We're almost out of time. Tell us just the broad outline of this book.
Well, I just want young couples, well, any couple, I want folks going into marriage to know that we're not to expect perfection from one another. One of my chapters is husbands don't have script writers, and so we aren't to be looking to this other person to do everything exactly the way we think it ought to be done. And to know that in the midst of all of this called marriage, that marriage is a marathon, and no one can sprint a marathon. So I've just shared some of the things that I had to learn the hard way. And I want to encourage people to lighten up, to enjoy one another, and to concentrate on what truly is important in marriage, and not to get silly about all of these fringe things that so many times will weigh down a relationship.
Sandra, you're a neat lady. It's a delight to have you here. This new book has an interesting cover on it. I hope it sells a lot.
Bless your heart.
And as you go around the country and you meet all these folks, greet them for us, will you?
Thank you. That'll be a privilege.
You are a survivor. If there is a message that you have to give to the people out there who are struggling, either wives who perceive themselves to be in impossible marriages, or single parents who think there's no way that I can deal with this, or perhaps widows who have lost a loved one, you have demonstrated that you can make it. You can survive.
With the Lord's help, yes.
And you didn't have all those answers when it first happened to you, did you?
No, we rarely do, but we just muddle through by hanging on to the Lord, and we suddenly find out we're not muddling anymore. We're hanging on to Him and walking on good ground.
Sandra, we miss you. Drop in and see us, will you? When I don't have the flu, you come by and say hello.
Thank you, I shall.
God's blessings to you.
And God bless you.
Well, what a wonderful visit we have enjoyed with Sandra Aldrich on today's edition of Focus on the Family. You can see why we think so highly of her. This program is provided on a regular basis by Focus on the Family. Our producer has been John Fuller. Engineering and production were handled by Jim Adam and David Salkeld. Our executive producer is Bobby Valentine. Our host is psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson. And I'm Mike Trout, inviting you back when we'll again turn our hearts toward home.